Today's podcast is full of questions about proportionality in the big serious issues about Iran and Israel and Gaza. As Murray Black put it, is proportionality present either in Iran's response to Israel's attack on its embassy in Damascus with all those missiles, or in Israel's pounding for 192 days of Gaza? We look at that proportionality in much less serious ways, but still the question of wood-burning stoves. Is that the main thing that government really wants to say to people living in rural Scotland when we have some of the least affordable heating actually in Europe? And we look as well at some of the other issues of the day, including my own brush with Lyme disease, which is under control.
Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, chums, and welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast. And I am, that was a jaunty ear there.
It was. I was actually laughing listening to you, Pat, because, I mean, without giving the game away, sure, you did the most extraordinary snog before you started speaking. Yeah. So I'm assuming you're still a little lurgied.
Yes, still a little lurgied. I got the old nasal thing going on. I'm like, I can do a Kenneth Williams, I'm my trin. You know, I could actually...
You can't do that.
I can't.
Can you do that anymore? No.
No.
I'm afraid I can now trump your snog.
Yes, yes.
Lyme disease.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre. I mean, yeah. I can't remember if I even mentioned it, but the weirdest 3 days over Easter, which I assumed was just one of these viral things.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out it was all the symptoms of Lyme disease, which just, you know, in case anybody else is wondering, I mean, for me anyway, was like somebody had taken a hammer and smashed your left hand, and then shaking all the time, being utterly knackered, feeling that your teeth were coming out. I mean, it was just dreadful. But the symptoms moved about every 5 hours. They just kept moving on to something else, as well as being so knackered, you just flopped from seat to seat. So I just thought that was some terrible virus thing. And then had this kind of feeling like, I would describe it like if somebody had taken a nettle and just slightly brushed it against your back.
Right.
That's all. You know, it was nothing more than just, you know, just that, nothing big. And of course, I live on my own. So the difficulty is nobody's looking at my back. And it's actually quite hard. So, you know, I kept thinking, and then finally got the mirror out and had a look. And my God, you know, I mean, what a shock, because about half my back was covered in a big target. It's all you could describe it as. So I took a picture of that. I'll tell you, holding the mirror up and taking a picture at the same time, as well as keeping your lady bits out of the picture, that took some doing, right? But anyway, I couldn't get an appointment that day, but sent it by email. And thank God now you're able to do this, you know, send pictures to doctors by email, because he looked at it at lunchtime, sort of went, that is 100% Lyme disease. You know, there's just no two ways about it. So I was straight on to the old antibiotics, and I'm still pretty knackered, but it would seem that, you know, that it's faded a little bit already. So it's definitely kind of working, and it makes sense of stuff that just seemed weird, you know, which is in a funny kind of way, not so bad. Meanwhile, I was off at Kirkcaldy Hospital because I've got this autoimmune problem, vasculitis in my kidneys, which has no symptoms that I recognize whatsoever, but means I've had a monthly blood test for 11 years and I've been on various stuff. So the good news is that I'm in slow decline.
Yeah.
I thought, wow, you know, I mean, she's she's not quite saying you're a bit of a, you know, I mean, I'm absolutely not a medical wonder of any kind, you know, but I mean, fundamentally, there's, you know, I'm still in okay shape for 10 years on immunosuppressants and stuff. So I came skipping out of there, you know, just like slow decline. I'll take that. Just thought, what a wonderful day it is, and the sun's shining, and the thrift is coming up in the little patchy bits in the middle of motorways and things like that. So yeah, all in all, I'm feeling knackered, but fine.
Knackered, but in slow decline. Yeah, I mean, it's funny when you told me about it, Leslie. I went, Lyme disease. Is that the tick bite thing?
Of course,
yes. Because
the weird thing about it is, that if you factor in, you know, it's 21 days generally beforehand that you might have been bitten, right? So if you kind of back time that from Easter, that takes you back to the beginning of March, and you think, how did a tick get me in the middle of March? And now, I don't know if this is rubbish, because that really wasn't, I did have a bit of a climb of Benachie actually when mm-hmm. I was up in Aberdeenshire, and it was so hot. I remember actually stripping down to a fairly strappy top. Could have been that.
Yeah.
But also, I'm noticing now, because, you know, if I go up through the garden, there's a willow tree with long pendulous, mm-hmm. you know, willowy bits, which is beautiful. But you brush through it every time you walk up. And I was right. just watching the birds every morning. They get into all the branches and everything, because there's wee beasties, and, you know, that's what the birds are after. And I thought, right, how many wee beasties do you think there are in this tree? And you brush uh-huh. under it almost every day. So that'll be today's slow ambling exercise. I'll be just actually cutting a path through it so that I'm not always brushing things. Yeah. But so yeah. I'd have no idea otherwise how that happened.
Yeah, I would say, because I had heard of it, believe it or not, because the USPGA champion in 2016, one of the major winners, Jimmy Walker, he had to, he putted in golf because he identified it with what they call, if you're standing in a putt and you start shaking, it's called the yips. He was jerking his putts. And then he's now successfully recovered, and he's playing golf, not on the PGA, but with the Blood Money Sport Washing Live Tour, but that's what he's doing. And just as an aside, because we began with that, a very interesting piece in today's National about the Every Doctor campaign, which has now published a map that you can check up your constituency to see how far privatisation has gone in your local area. And I tried it. And it's the interesting thing, Leslie, is that I thought, no, I am in North East Fife, and I went down the alphabet colour. I thought, no, there's no North East Fife there. So I'll try Fife North East. No, it's not there. And I thought, come on, Joyce, what age have you got to? And you've forgotten the name of the political analyst and anything like that. If you've got the name of the constituency you live in. So I checked it up. Yeah, North East Fife. And then it suddenly occurred to me that the reason why this wasn't showing up in terms of privatisation was because there was no privatisation in North East Fife. And when you examine the map, you can compare and contrast the amount of privatisation that's gone on in England in comparison to up here. Mm. And it's just ludicrous. And that brings into the point that when I'm talking about this NHS privatisation, I'm a middle-class lefty, according to our Wes, the man who received £173,000 in the past 15 months from donors who have connections to private healthcare. But the health service is safe in Labour's hands.
You know, you're just speechless with it. It's just so depressing to see that this is just going to be the same sort of pattern of behaviour as it has been with the Tories, really. But I mean, everybody listening to this will have got now chapter and verse on, you know, hardly a fag paper between them on almost anything now, actually. But the health, it's such a bad situation down south. And that, again, you know, I was speaking to somebody who works for the King's Fund recently, mm-hmm. and it was actually quite an odd conversation in a way, because I had to say to them, do you realise that the Health and Social Care Act 2012 that essentially created trusts, Jeremy Hunt, thanks a bunch, mate, started the privatisation that was so disastrous that at the beginning of COVID in 2021, in the first month, they just sneaked out that they had forgiven all the debts of all the health trusts, because otherwise mm-hmm. they would all have gone bust.
Yeah.
And I mean, I still find this one that I have to check with people who are in the health field, because I keep thinking, it's such an enormous thing that, did I just get it wrong? Did I imagine it? And I didn't, you know? So you have to kind of keep saying to people who are based, you know, who do a lot of their business or who are based down south, you know, we just didn't do that. It didn't apply to us, that whole thing. So naturally, you know, it's not like the 1950s here, but we still operate on, you know, a different principle than England that's now hopelessly lost in Virgin Healthcare run trusts. Yep. Who can actually sue government mm-hmm. for not giving them the chance to compete for contracts. And I just think people need to, you know, everybody needs to remember that this is what was installed down south, because it's now such a long time ago, 2012, which, you know, it's 12 years, right? That's longer than anybody's working memory, it seems. everyone down south thinks that's normal, and everybody up here doesn't realize that that's their normal, because you get treated up here, not down there, unless you've got rallies down south. And then you just get, I mean, I'm not trying to be complacent about difficulties here, but by gum, when you sort of hear people don't get admitted on a Friday ever anywhere, you know, south of the border particularly, all these kind of horror stories, a lot of it does arise from that privatisation that Jeremy Hunt consciously introduced, that the Lords, you know, here they are fighting the Rwanda bill. Well, they didn't fight this kind of stuff because so many of them come from a private healthcare background even. So, you know, the degree to which this norm is now bolted into both houses of Westminster is huge. You know, so that, I mean, we're registering what you mentioned about Wes Streeting. I'm sure nobody south of the border, you know, I mean, it's so normal to be, to have private healthcare involved in government, essentially, that probably nobody's batting an eyelid about it. And that's the degree of difference. And long may it blooming continue. And I'm delighted to know that I too live in a private healthcare free zone in that case, you know, and I can only once again just be, you know, gobsmacked by the care. Maybe I just happen to be that random person that keeps managing to, you know, land on my feet with healthcare. And by gum, I've used quite a bit of it. But that's it. People are courteous. The systems are obviously not, you know, they just about work. It's absolutely not okay. But we're not going to manage to get more money put into health and until we have independence and can manage to move some of these big budgets around.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I thought it was an interesting one because, again, what he Streeting wanted to say, the real betrayal is the two-tier system that sees people like them, that is middle-class lefties, treated faster, while working families like mine are left waiting for longer. I mean, and it is, it's just that aspect of it as well, Leslie, and he's writing in The Sun. And it's this Labour engaging in culture wars, which you then link into what David Lammy waving the union flag, you know, and turning around saying that was the flag that people fought under fighting against fascism, forgetting about the flag. That was the flag that people fought under in India and in Malaysia and right across Africa in terms of colonialization. So it is that whole restructuring. But when it comes to that, it's a political narrative decision they've taken. But when it comes to it, you're absolutely right. There's not a fag paper between them. And neither of them are going to be addressing the substantive issues that exist concerning the UK economy and its decline. It's declined over decades now in terms of growth and output and restructuring of our industrial sector. So, I mean, it is very, very, very disappointing. And I just hope at some point Anna Sarwar up here is actually going to be questioned on these matters, because you can take it from you can take it from me, folks, that if the NHS budgets, which have gone to private companies, and that takes money out of the system and it gives public money to private enterprises, if that continues, that of course has a knock-on effect on the administration and the budget available to the NHS up here. So yes, but there we go. That's, and it's funny because we began with you, Leslie, and that led us into an area I didn't think we were going to be going into. And I think people will know that the major issue that we're going to be talking about in this podcast, and on a substantial basis, is what has happened in terms of the post-Israel attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria. And the change that's taken place, and I don't know what you think about it, Leslie, but I think Netanyahu, that's his get out of jail free card. That's his get out of jail free card that dates right back to after that attack that took place in the United Nations Security Council. The UK, the US and France, who are permanent members of the Security Council, failed to endorse a motion censuring Israel for conducting that attack. And at that point, there's your joker, Israel, on you go. And it's made Iran react, and Iran has handed a victory to Netanyahu.
Yes, I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to hear. And again, everyone has to be careful with the way they frame this. For those who read the National, will have seen Mary Black's contribution yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
When she made it very clear that she was condemning Iran's attack.
Absolutely.
But if she was saying if David Cameron was rightly talking about proportionality with regard to that, with she said 100 missiles. I think there was considerably more than that, actually.
Yes.
But anyway, if there was a whole stack of missiles coming from Iran in response to, was it 7 or more people killed in their mm-hmm. embassy in Damascus, which is essentially an embassy, is territory of the actual country. So, essentially yeah. that's Iranian kind of territory. So you just not forget that started with this obviously calculated move to try to, as David Pratt said a couple of weeks ago, just after it happened, this looks like a whistle kind of call to get the United States back on board.
Absolutely.
To evince a response from the Iranians and to kind of, provoke the solidarity that we've now seen happen. But Mary Black's point was, because that is seems to be controversial to say, even though actually a lot of commentators have said mm-hmm. everyone has skipped over the fact that this began with Israel making an attack that they won't even own up to, actually, and which hardly anyone condemned.
Yeah.
But, her point was 100 plus missiles from Iran, disproportionate. Well, what's a 192-day bombardment of Gaza then?
Yes.
So, it's difficult to make these points because so quickly do you get labelled with, an Iranian sympathiser or whatever. And she spent a lot of time framing up her comments. And, let's remember the Iranians, Iran nearly, that Revolutionary Guard nearly got outlawed when Iran basically had a go at two of its newsreaders or mm-hmm. journalists who are based in the UK. And, that was an assassination attempt on British soil, just exactly the way that, things started with Putin when he used poison to attack dissidents, basically, in Britain. So, there's no point getting all dewy-eyed about the Iranians here at all. And obviously, there's been a massive internal civil issue within Iran with women yep. trying to have the right to, be able to wear what they want and not. So that, that's Iran. But still, here we are with just now the hope, that's what all it can be, that behind the scenes there's a lot of diplomacy on the go to make Israel think, okay, no one was killed in all of that barrage, nothing got through, everything was shot down by a series of systems that are quite unbelievable. And just as an aside, people who are expert in this are talking about the different kinds of missiles and where they were launched from, and just quietly mentioned the cost. £1 million mm-hmm. for each cruise missile or more, probably, because in the stack of different types of missiles, I may have misfiled that. But if you've then got, you've got almost a, possibly £1 billion worth of missiles just to make a point in a region which is not far from starvation. And it's just, it's obscene, the whole thing, actually, as to this is what you do. To try to kind of maneuver and hold your position. But here we are. And, there's so much pressure now. People, anyone listening to the news will know Netanyahu is now kind of getting it from every direction, basically. And many, many people within Israel pushing for early elections. It's just a question of essentially how long that can stumble on. But what has happened there would seem to have kind of bolstered his position.
Absolutely.
for a wee while, because then what happens? Is he still going to go towards trying to reconquer territory around Rafah? Because, the second any of that stuff happens, the pendulum swings right back again.
Yeah, because what you're actually faced with is that apparently, according to reports in the United States of America, that the pressure that was being placed on Israel to actually roll back on what it was the stated aims that is going to further military incursion in Gaza, that's come to a dead halt. that's come to a dead halt because, and both sides, the Democrats and Republicans, both voted in the House of Representatives to give even further aid to Israel, you know. But in Tehran, I mean, the Iranian regime is under immense pressure from its own people, as you said, Leslie, on economic grounds and humanitarian grounds. And now they've revealed themselves to be militarily incompetent. And what their statement is now, well, we fired all this off. It didn't work. Chaps, that's it over. That's over with. But I mean, is that the point that you're making as well, is that you've been terribly careful about this? I mean, I was reading Professor Craig Martin. He's a professor of international public law and the law of armed conflict at Washburn University. And he says Israel's airstrike, yeah, was in a violation of UN Charter's prohibition on the use of force. He says so was Iran's response. And when I was listening to this, and I was listening to David Cameron being interviewed by Adam, big thumbs up to Kay Burley for asking the question, what would the UK have done if it was our embassy that was attacked by a foreign power? And he said, we would respond proportionately. And I'm thinking, what kind of madhouse do we live in? Mm. We are actually constructing UN Charter pieces of legislation to actually account for what is a proportionate response in terms of these acts. And the other bit of it as well is there's the necessity of actually labelling someone who actually questions something as being Team Hamas, Team Iran, Team Israel. You know, everybody's got to be on a team. There cannot be something that actually says, no, I condemn the Iranian regime. It's an appalling regime. I condemn the state of Israel that's currently constructed, and I condemn the Netanyahu government. I condemn what it does. And that is a position that people should be able to take without fingers being pointed at you as being on team anyone.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But I mean, we're still sitting with this situation now. I mean, I was reading a really interesting piece in The Spectator, which is a, you know, rare enough sentence by Jake Wallace Simpson, who himself is, let me just get his credentials. He's editor of the Jewish Chronicle. Mm-hmm. And his view is basically that Hamas has all but won. Now, let me just look at the date that was written. It was actually, I just can't quite remember if this is actually at the point of the Iranian counteroffensive, but it was certainly after the Israeli attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. And he's basically saying, well, where are we with all of this? And he was talking about after the Israeli IDF soldiers had pulled out of Khan Yunus, a barrage of rockets was fired from the freshly vacated town, which basically showed, I mean, that's twice now that mm-hmm. you know, Khan Yunus has been cleansed, as it were, of Hamas. And clearly they were there, you know, instantly. And what he's saying is the idea of what you could, you know, the IDF that he's saying would have to evacuate 1.4 million people from Rafah and direct them to a safe zone in the coastal area, which would also require construction. And he's asking, with the cooperation of which aid agency, do you think? Mm-hmm. And which international allies? So, you know, he's kind of saying behind the scenes, the truth is, as he's putting it, after 6 months of blood and tears, what's the result? Huge destruction in Gaza, partial conquest of the north, 130 hostages still in captivity, and Hamas, while degraded, far from destroyed. And so, you know, he's kind of saying that level of, that's failure. And he's also saying, you know, that basically tens of thousands of Israelis are displaced, living in hotels at the taxpayers' expense. You know, it's a bit that you don't really know too much about. Gaza lies in ruins. In his words, Israel is hated around the world. So, you know, this is not success in anybody's view. And I mean, there's got to be a point, and you hear it from a lot of the more sensible speakers, you know, I'm struggling to remember his Christian name, Olmert, the previous Labour Prime Minister of Israel, was on Channel 4 News again. Actually, he was saying Netanyahu should just take the win of not all those missiles being basically blocked, and absolutely not be tanking back in. And there should just be a general election as soon as possible, albeit that, you know, it's not as if the cavalry's coming in anything that most of us would regard as a progressive response. But in the kind of changing shape of coalitions, you could only hope for something a bit more moderate. And in his words, Ehud Olmert, he was saying, you know, the absolute emphasis has got to be a long-term agreement with the Palestinians. Okay, that's one voice, you know, and the reason he's an ex-prime minister is he's not involved in stuff today. But you can only hope that the pause that there's been, that still continues to be, is the result of diplomatic pressure, and that everyone doesn't now just get fed up and waltz off. And clearly the points that Hamza Yousef has been making all along about the need to have a pause, to a ceasefire, it's never meant let's just call for a ceasefire and then I'll go away and talk about something else. It's as a precursor to just stabilizing people. I mean, still people, you see, are in Gaza trying to make their way back towards homes with the IDF within Gaza turning them back. I just can't even imagine what that's like. I mean, can you imagine everybody? I'm sorry to bring it down to the basics, but every time you walk and you put the kettle on, you can't do it. Mm-hmm. Every time you go to the loo, you can't do that. Every time you wash your bairn, can't do that. You know, everything, you open the fridge, there's no fridge. It's just, it's really quite incomprehensible what normal has now become, but it has to add up to something.
Yeah. I mean, and when you said the cavalry isn't coming, because Benny Gantz, who's hailed as the great hero, the liberal, who's still in the war cabinet, said, "We will build a regional coalition and exact the price from Iran in the fashion and timing that is right for us." And the other thing is that a former director general of Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs said, "This has been a war against Iran from the start. And what you've got to do is we've got to finish the job in Gaza, which is going to be painful for the Iranians." All this started because they wanted to save Hamas. And that, of course, elides over that connection between Netanyahu and the links that they developed with Hamas in order to undermine the Palestinian Authority. I mean, it is an absolute mess. But as I say, that I go back to the UK, the US and France not taking part and not agreeing to that resolution at the United Nations. And then that was a failure. And it's a failure that led to an Iranian response, which was based upon their weakness at home and the knowledge, probably, I would think, again, I'm not a military expert, that the Iron Dome, all the other facilities that the Israelis have, including UK and French fighter jets, to be able to knock down all these missiles and survive. And we'll see what happens there. But again, this is all being framed about the fact, and it's reframing the question, if you like, that this is not a war against the Palestinians. This is this is a war against Hamas, which is backed by this potential nuclear power of Iran. And the other thing, I mean, what we forget is that the Iran nuclear agreement was jettisoned by Donald Trump. And that was jettisoned. And that is now the card that can be held by Netanyahu, saying, look, the Iranians are going ahead and they can develop nuclear weapons. Look what would happen if Iran had a nuclear weapon. You know, that's sitting right there. What could they do if they had a nuclear weapon? Again, not looking at the fact that Israel, as we know for a fact, has a nuclear arsenal. So it's one of these ones where, you know, everybody's wrong, and as you said, it's the Palestinians, that the people in Gaza, the ordinary citizens, who are bearing the brunt of this geopolitical mess that they're in.
Yep, agreed.
God, yeah. So that, but there was a bit that came closer to home on it, Leslie. Where, and I do apologise because I've only read the name, which is the new University of Glasgow rector, Dr. Ghassan Abu Sita, who's British Palestinian, who's been working in Gaza and has written and spoken in harrowing terms about he's a paediatric specialist and surgeon, about what he's been having to do in the operating suite on kids. And he was due to speak in Germany to a conference which was going to be hearing witnesses. It was labelled as a pro-Palestinian conference. He arrived in Germany, He was held for about 3.5 hours. He was turned back and told that he could not participate in any such event, either live or on Twitter or on Skype or on Zoom or any other forum, and then that the event itself was banned. And it's a very worrying aspect there, in terms of when you frame it within the fact that Germany is currently defending itself at the International Court of Justice against Nicaraguan charges that's accomplice to genocide in Gaza. But it's the Germans have a very, very odd relationship, don't they, with Israel. And what they said is that it's one of its, Israel's security is its status of razón, its reason of state, which was coined by a German ambassador to Israel in the early 2000s. And it seems to be that Germany will support Israel no matter what it does. And it's back to the thing I said earlier, Owen Jones was being heavily criticised because he actually stated the fact that Germany, because of the obscenity of the Holocaust, was now reversing itself and had this tunnel vision on Gaza and Israel purely because of its collective guilt because of the Holocaust. And that's Germany, again, imprisoning and arresting prominent Jewish activists who are opposing the war. So it's come to a pass where Jewish activists who are opposing the war in Gaza are being labelled as anti-Semitic and being imprisoned in Germany under anti-Semitic laws. So it's the mad world through the looking glass that we're living in when it comes to this.
Yeah, we talked about this a wee while ago when a friend of mine was whose parents are in Berlin was making that point that it's quite scary to go out at the moment because she's wanting to go out on Palestinian demonstrations. But there's a phalanx of the extreme right now present in great numbers even. And Berlin was always, historically, mm-hmm. Berlin was actually a very sort of lefty, well, West Berlin was, because it was the only place you could go to dodge conscription in West Germany, the old West. So that anybody who wanted to kind of dodge conscription, yeah. I mean, that was to keep the numbers up, basically, because, you know, there was for that long period where West Berlin was sitting isolated, you know, in the mm-hmm. midst of East Germany, there was a struggle to kind of keep people wanting to be there because it was a weird kind of existence to live just in that little bubble where you couldn't go beyond mm-hmm. West Berlin in any direction. So I remember because I went there to cover something connected to the City of Culture in 1990 in Glasgow. Pat Lally had taken, you wouldn't believe it, the kind of Glasgow Miles Better taxi all the way to blooming Berlin.
Jeez.
You know, I mean, never a man to sort of like, pull all his punches when it came to publicity. So he was in the midst of that. There was an IMF thing going on at the same time. There was massive anti-capitalism demonstrations going on in West Berlin. And there was Pat in the middle of it, getting out of the Glasgow Miles Better taxi to go into some meeting. So I saw all of this, and you know, they even used to actually have to bring the kind of the armed forces within West Berlin were actually therefore not drawn from the locals because they were all, you know, sort of mm-hmm. pacifists basically. So you know, it would be people from further the parish who had absolutely no sympathy whatsoever for sort of lefty demonstrators. So it kind of created a different sort of vibe within West Berlin, which is slightly, I mean, obviously that's now in the tumble of how Berlin now exists. You know, since reunification, there's all sorts of different political directions mm-hmm. coming together. But It's so hard to shrug off. I mean, that past, it's physically there still, no matter how you want to look at it. And I mean, this is what that terrible period has done to Germany, but does to any country when it sort of loses itself. It just, you lose your reputation. You lose so much for a century, you know, coming on. So anyway, yeah, it is a deeply horrible situation.
Yeah, it's And as again, it's one of these ones where, I mean, people know, you know me, Leslie, I always like to have a link or a smart link out of something, but there's nothing I can actually say about that in terms of it, of what's going on in Germany. And I'll be intrigued to see what the decision of the International Court of Justice is on this, because Germany is a massive arms exporter. Massive arms exporter to Israel, major one, and it seems to be doing even better under current circumstances in terms of it's increasing its arms exports to Israel. But on a slightly more domestic matter, which may affect quite a few of the people who listened to this podcast, and it's an odd one because it caused a significant stooshy, which you wouldn't think would be possible, wood burning stoves. But there's a bit more to the whole background to the wood-burning stoves and its implications, as you wrote about in The National.
Yes, I mean, I know a lot of people just sort of think, look, get over it. I mean, there's all sorts of changes going to have to happen, and they will, actually. But I think the thing is, with everything politically, there is a context in which change is received. And it's also a context of whether or not you feel you've been involved in it, whether you think you're getting fair done by in other respects. And this wood burning stove thing has been like the last straw, I think. I mean, mm-hmm. The number of people who've now written about it is blooming legion, you know. There's all sorts of kind of things that don't add up. So, for example, right now, you cannot put, for example, a biomass system into a new house, but you can get a subsidy for installing it in an existing house. Mm-hmm. How does that work? It's the same kit, you know what I mean? Now, I appreciate when you make change, there's got to be a point. And actually, old Rishi Sunak's thing, you know, people are about the cigarette ban, you know, so that mm-hmm. nobody born after 2008 will ever be able to legally buy cigarettes. You know, people are objecting that somebody when they're 20, you know, well, whatever, you know, when they're 24, somebody will be OK to buy, or I can't remember what age it actually kicks in. But, you know, just one day suddenly makes you unable to buy a cigarette, you know, where the next guy, just one day, that just puts you on the wrong side of the law. So, of course, when there's changes, there will be sort of apparently nonsensical things like this. And of course, there's this thing about emergency use. Well, come on in, girls and boys, you know, I mean, I was just recounting my own experience, and obviously I'm not living in the middle of nowhere. It's 20 minutes drive from the centre of Dundee, 5 minutes off the A92. We had 5 power cuts here this winter, and, you know, we're not in the back of beyond. Then you're thrown back onto candles, tilly lamps, flasks, open fires, wood-burning stoves, and one another. Yeah. And that's the point, because, you know, a lot of communities have just become DIY communities that know that the council is not coming fast. And again, we're pretty lucky here. We've got a lot of younger people who are pretty able. And in Stormarwen, there was a wee gang out, 7:30 in the morning. The guys were up there, chainsaws. And they cleared one of the roads. All the roads out of here had trees down. And over time, that group and the estate, to be fair, a lot of that just got horsed off onto the local landed estate. But, you know, a lot of the rest of it did actually get chopped up and used by people who live in tied houses with single glazing, mm-hmm. only open fires and, you know, wood burning stoves, or the most expensive white meter heating. Unbelievably expensive, even before the cost of living crisis, people moving out, as far as I had heard, from new build in social housing in the Highlands because they couldn't afford the white meter heating. So all of that is kind of the quid pro quo for living in really, really difficult circumstances. Now, I know everyone comes in and says, but they're not affected, right? So, you know, if you're basically existing stuff, it's not going to change. But what is the hope of these folk? A lot of it is that one day they'll manage to, like the house I'm in was an estate house, and the folk before me managed to buy it off the estate. So, you know, slowly it's got improved along the time. Well, that's what a lot of folk are hoping for, because the estates own the land. You're only ever going to get perhaps when they've, you know, land on hard times, they'll maybe flog one house here, one house there. That's what you're going to get. And to sort of think that you then have to upgrade it so much that it's able to hit all the standards of heating minus what's around you, which is blooming wood, mm-hmm. you know. So it's kind of all of that comes together for me into a sort of really. And it's kind of like, if you're going to get involved in our lives, if we're actually on the grid as far as planning and people giving a shit basically is concerned here, then do you know there's quite a number of other things that people would probably like to see you getting involved with first, which might well be affordable housing, affordable heating, land reform, you know, healthcare, no local post offices nearby, no bus services, no bus service here. All of that stuff. And so the fact that the first government intervention in country lives is to stop the only perk that comes from living near a forest feels a bit wrong.
Yeah. I mean, is this an example, along with other things, Leslie, of the urban-centric perspective that possibly successive Scottish governments, including this SNP-led one, have towards policy development?
Well, yes, in that, but it's sort of, it's different in each occasion. Yeah, it is. Although I'm no sort of Fergus Ewing follower on this one, mm-hmm. because I think it's much more, it feels to me much more like completer finishers that just don't reality proof anything. And for sure, if you actually did have people, if there was more, you know, they'll do consultation, like the HPMA consultation mm-hmm. that was basically, would you like to not be able to fish somewhere near you with no compensation? What do you think about that then? I mean, that's not a consultation, right?
No.
That's just kind of crazy. And this is the problem when you don't have governance structures in communities, real, you know, vibrant communities. Yeah. You don't have any sort of, if you had a borough council, and you basically had to talk to the borough council and its councillors as to whether or not it wanted to not be able to fish. I think that would be an interesting conversation, but you don't so easily. So I think there's that difficulty that basically there's not enough real locality going on. And I'll concede that the Western Isles Council is actually one of the smaller councils in Scotland, so I'm sure it had some frisky views if it was asked. But generally speaking, a lot of this feels like people who, you know, stuff looks like it makes sense. Why wouldn't you? You could say, mm-hmm. you know, there is a green agenda. Fine. But it's picking off the small things. You know, again, I keep coming back to this, and I've actually had a lot of interesting communication, never ends actually now, on district heating systems. Mm-hmm. But if you were to kind of say, here's what we're doing for you, we're now putting, you know, a massive amounts of effort into trying to create systems for, especially, you know, it's never going to hit rural Scotland to the same degree, although it should be quite possible, having looked at the Denmark film, look at the example of Samso people. There's 4,000 people on an island that's pretty well net zero already. They're just using what's there. They're using straw with kind of relatively little distance of travel to incinerate, just like the big system in Copenhagen. They're using filters and carbon capture actually within the system in Copenhagen to make sure that they're not pumping out massive amounts mm-hmm. of CO2. And so that's a kind of possibility for how you work in rural areas, which just nobody is taking on here, because essentially nothing is small enough to be able to make those kind of connections and economies of scale. Although thank you to Jimmy Black from Dundee, who is involved with Scottish Housing News and has been involved with a scheme that started in Edinburgh. I'm going to get the name of it wrong. I think it's Shaw Fair, which is a new village, and it is totally being heated on a district heating scheme. The difficulty that's been cited by the folk that are putting that together is the retrofitting. It's easy to do when you're actually putting the stuff in one fell swoop, in one mm-hmm. estate, in one type of tenure, you know, in one organized go, trying to weed your way through. You know, it's like, it reminds me a little bit of the kind of difficulties that beset the tram in Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. Where the amount of gubbins basically beneath the surface that were being encountered, you know, sort of all sorts of different services, pipes, water pipes, all of that stuff. That has to be sorted to put new pipes in. I have no idea how easy or hard that is, except that the guys connected to this new one in Edinburgh say that is one of the difficulties. But OK, it's difficult. We need to get on with it. And I would love to see the positive advance on a big thing like that before you start putting pernickety things like this on people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned the Denmark film there, Leslie, and I know you were attacked by a tick, which resulted in the Lyme disease. But the Denmark film seems to have irritated all the right people, as far as I'm concerned, and it launched a quite series of attacks on the Denmark film and stuff that was in it. I mean, and I know you've responded online to it, but I think, I mean, would you like a chance to give some answers to that now, or is that just, not to heck with it, let it all go by?
Well, slightly. I mean, it is very wearing, actually, to have this. Sam Taylor, who I think is from these islands or whatever, had picked up this question about whether it's possible for the incinerator that was focused on in Copenhagen to be, you know, to be not pumping out massive amounts of climate changing gases. And, you know, you can only look at kind of what's available on Copenhagen, which, sorry, I'm clicking around here trying to find the, because I'm no scientist. It's fitted with carbon capture. CO2 is scrubbed from the flue gas using a liquid with basic amines. Fine, folks, somebody will know better than me.
Well, they are, yeah.
The captured CO2 is stored and recycled as fuel. The carbon capture reduces the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And they're now piloting this plant across this waste to energy facility in Copenhagen, the big plant that is featured in the film, so that it could be used in the rest. The point would be that what happens when you switch to district heating? And this was a point made by many Danes, actually, was that at the beginning, when this happens, you know, looking back at it now, the switch was simply they weren't, you know, a lot of these incinerators were burning without any kind of control on the emissions that were coming because it was still better than gas and coal. And when they began, that was good news. As time goes on, that's not good enough news. So, you know, then the kit has to be improved. There has to be modifications made. There has to be new technology used. But the beauty of it is you're just adapting one big piece of kit. What we're doing here, and what Sam and all these people are just, it's what drives me bonkers about this, is can we just talk about the blooming issue at the core of this, which is why do we not have socialized heating in Britain?
Yeah.
And that is because Thatcher privatized so much and people lost track of what is normal across Europe, which is to have energy supplied heating supplied collectively. Now, when you start doing that, you're able to get to a moment where we're at now, where the green transition means one or two or 10, in the case of Copenhagen, changes to their big boiler plants that serve 98% of people in Copenhagen. 10. When you're talking about the green transition in a city like Edinburgh, same size as Copenhagen, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of individual boilers. Now, this is the point. And can we just leave all the stuff about independence or otherwise out of this for a second? Do we not want to try to make it easier forevermore to keep upgrading our heating systems as soon as we know more about what we're damaging? And that's the beauty of having central, you know, boiler plants. The fact that somebody just wants to sit and try and find some little blooming thing they can niggle away at, when the bigger lesson is to collectively, to do as much as you can collectively when it comes to heating and energy, because it's what then lifts that burden from every individual from here on in. And it means you know, you're not a drag on the system, because anybody currently who's asked to spend 10 to 20,000 quid on shifting their heating to a green system will just go, I haven't got that money.
Yeah.
And they're not going to do it. So that's the reason we will keep bumping along at the bottom, failing to hit all our green objectives. It's heating that's causing so much of our problems. And when it comes back to that, why is that? Let me think.
Yeah.
It's this, right? So that's the annoying. I mean, just the other stuff is just,
yeah,
right, okay, I've control myself. Nonsense, which the Daily Express or the Sunday Express or something turned into a story without checking any of it, described me as, I don't, can't remember what, but, you know, sort of involved with Nordic Horizons, which was a taxpayer funded. I mean, Jesus.
We did it at work.
Yeah. Well, you know, it did get a grant of about £17,000 per year for about 5 years from the Scottish Government, which funded the transport and hotel of 6 speakers per year and 10 days of administration from another volunteer to run it. I got perhaps £200 about 3 times over the course of 11 years to support some of the visits I made, which otherwise were funded by me doing journalism. Essentially, I put 2 months a year for 11 years into creating Nordic Horizons and keeping it going. And then you have to sit and read that little, you know, jibey remark that suggests that you're just some massive, great ligger. And just by the way, Nordic Horizons hasn't taken any money from the Scottish Government since 2018, 2019. So it's kind of like just wrong, actually. And by the by, the film says nothing about Scottish independence.
Exactly.
It's about Denmark. Hello. So you read into it what you want. And the point of all of this is it's not propaganda. It's just here's how a country works. Here's how it works with its neighbours. Here's how it heats itself, educates itself. That's the point. So the end.
Yes, because Sam and his ilk are in Team Union. And no matter what, anything else that comes up about the possibilities of it, if it's any way, shape or form they can actually beat with a, this is a pro-independent stick, they will do it because they're on Team Union. And that's the, as I say, back to the sort of thing I despise, where people are not prepared to take a logical, constructive look at ideas from anywhere because of their narrow tunnel vision.
Yeah, but happily, about 15,000 people so far have watched the film and, you know, seem to have rather liked it, which is fine. There was a another gig in Elgin that I did a couple of days ago, whatever, which again was, you know, full and a great discussion, actually, with scarily enough, a real Dane in the audience, which is that's the kind of scrutiny that you just go broad, you know. So that actually went very well. That Dane ended up his comments where he was saying, you know, he said nothing is inaccurate in this film. You know, this is what exists. It does look a lot more glamorous the way that you kind of put it together than what it feels like. And this is always the case from, you know, 11, 12 years doing stuff in the Nordic countries. And you'll think about it the same here. You know, if anyone came around and said to you, yeah, you've got a brilliant health service compared to England, your immediate thing is to jump in and say, well, we've got problems with, you know what I mean? And that's true for all these countries. You know, they're only conscious of change over time. So, you know, people will think it used to be better 20 years ago, or, you know, we used to have more solidarity before, and then just insert, you know, what change has people feel has changed their lives. And that's true. But if you're making big, long sweeps of stories about a country, the relatively small changes that have happened lately are hard to concentrate on. You're trying to kind of give the sweep of the way a country works. So anyway, that's enough of that.
Yeah, but speaking of independence, big march this weekend, I believe.
Yes, indeed. I believe in Scotland has got a rally and a sort of some sort of groovy festival thing happening afterwards. I've got to say, I won't be there. I'm doing the Hutters rally in Dundee, which had been which had been decided, you know, advertised from last year. So I'm advertised as a speaker with that. And I'm actually at a stage now with this blooming thing, this Lyme disease thing, that every time I try to have a day where there's 3 or 4 things in it, now that I look back in the last month, I just cope, you know. So the idea of doing that thing, then jumping on the train, getting down. And in any case, there's a very strong lineup of speakers. So, I'm sure people will, you know, will turn up and it'll be a great event. And likewise, if anybody's interested in the Hutter stuff, that looks like it's, you know, it only happens every couple of years. But there's a lot of great speakers in that. And it just sounds like it's going to be a tremendous event in the Caird Hall.
Oh, right. Oh, Care Talks. I love the Care Talk. And what we'll do is we'll put up links and details about both on the podcast notes.
Well, see, here's the kind of stuff that you can, just to say that I'm not trying to pull people away from the Glasgow event, but if you are interested in Hutter's, here's the different panels. So this is kind of like, how different can your life get? 5 ways to build a hut, building with unusual materials, huts for healing, volunteering on hut builds, scrounging, low cost, low impact building, composting loos. You know, it's incredibly practical, and it's great to see that despite all the problems with land and the enduring situation, as I understand it, that woodland attracts, you can invest in woodland as an alternative to paying inheritance tax. Which just knackers, you know, there should be, it should be possible for groups of people to pull together and buy wee bits of woodland, but it's really difficult. On the other hand, there are more and more people who've got bits of land and are sort of feeling, well, we just want to do something a bit better with it. And that's the bit I don't know anyone had quite anticipated would kick in so strongly. So it isn't just completely bad news, albeit we are, I'm still a million miles away from the situation in the Nordics.
Well, on that, and I will use that Dundee phrase, that's hot for this week. We'll see you next week, chaps.